Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out. Consult a doctor prior to use.
You look amazing. What have you been doing?
You've heard of Ozempic, Wegovy, and other GLP-1 medications, right? Well, if you qualify, Zelday providers can prescribe semaglutide, the same active ingredient, at up to 90% less without insurance. Done all online.
No wait at the doctor's office or pharmacy?
No wait. Zelday can ship the same active ingredients as other expensive GLP-1s to your door.
Get started with Zelday today for just $39. Call #250 and say keyword care. That's the same active ingredients in Wegovy or Ozempic, but for 80 to 90% less. That's #250 keyword care.
Well, hello there, film fans and music fans, I hope. It can be both. Welcome along to Soundtracking with me, Edith Bowman. Lovely to have you with us. Thank you very much for your time and your ears. Really appreciate it. Just before I jump into this week's second episode, I hope you enjoyed our Sean Baker just celebrating Anora's amazing win at the Oscars. If you haven't listened to that yet, dive in. It's a short and sweet and lovely chat, and he's just adorable and inspired, and I can't wait to have him back on to talk about Florida Project and Tangerine and all his other brilliant, brilliant films. Now listen, because of us dropping extra episodes, our 500th episode is kind of approaching us very, very quickly. In fact, it's going to be here in about 4 or 5 weeks if we keep going at the rate that we are. So we are reaching out to you, our listeners, for a kind of last gasp to get your contribution in, basically. We wanted to try within our 500th episode to celebrate with you, the people who make it possible really for us to continue making this podcast. So all we ask is that you email us either an email and I can read it out for you, or you can record a little voice note, or you can record a little video, and it could be your favorite soundtrack, the moment that you fell in love with soundtracks, the moment that you fell in love with a guest that we've had on the show, your favorite guest, your favorite episode, whatever it is. We would love so much to include you in that 500th episode. So to do that, you can email me info@edithbowman.com, or you could just drop it across to me on DMs on our socials. We are at Soundtracking UK. So off you go. Well, not right now, maybe after this episode, because our latest guest on Soundtracking is composer Bear McCreary, who joins us to discuss his career ahead of his Themes and Variations tour, which kicks off at Indigo O2 on April the 18th. That's in London, by the way, for those of you in other parts of the world. And then he's heading off to Europe and the US. Now, Bear is, just great company. Also compiled an extraordinary body of work across film, TV, video games, including Battlestar Galactica, Outlander, God of War, so much stuff. And he is a joy to talk to, as I said. So let's get straight into it with his iconic theme from none other than The Walking Dead.
Hey, Edith, how's it going?
I'm great, thanks so much. How are you?
I'm doing very well. What time is it for you?
It's 5:30. I've just fed the kids and so they're all fed and watered, which is great. What about you? Where are you?
It's 9:30, so I just fed the kids breakfast, you know?
Oh, man. Oh, well, thank you for getting up early for us. Thank you starting your day with us. I appreciate it so much. Actually, I just quickly checked in with my son, Rudy, who's 16, who absolutely devoured God of War, and I told him I was chatting to, and he's like, oh, tell him I thought it was, the music was genuinely, I've written it down here, incredible. It was immaculate and so captivating.
Wow, those are great adjectives. I will take them, thank you. Please pass along my compliments.
Oh well, yeah, thank you, mutual appreciation. I love it. Listen, it would be impossible of me to think that I could in any way scratch the surface of your career in kind of one sitting, as you celebrate such an incredible collection of work that you're kind of finally taking on the road, though. This is
Yeah,
exciting.
I'm really excited about it, and
Yeah.
it feels like the right time, and it's the right time, I think, for fans, but it's
Yeah.
the right time for me. I have spent the better part of the last 20 years in a room like this one, 12 to 15 hours a day, and it's time to get out there. And really, some of my best memories of the last 20 years have been performing Battlestar Galactica, doing concert tours in the late 2000s, and then playing God of War live when it was announced in 2016, playing the
Wow.
song from God of War Ragnarok with Hozier on stage in 2022. I mean, these are highlights for me, and I finally realized that it was silly of me to wait for those opportunities to materialize. I should just
Yeah.
make them.
What's the process been for you in terms of working out the set list?
Very fun. I put out a rock record last year, The
Yeah.
Singularity, which was sort of designed to be a very fun live experience. Every song on the record is a fun one to hear live. So I sort of started there, and then I even did that whole record live, top to bottom, last year in Los Angeles. And for the tour, it's not the Singularity tour, it's the Themes and Variations tour.
Yeah.
And I started bringing in pieces that I thought would fit well in a rock context, which is a lot, surprisingly. And it's a lot. The set list is currently massive. We'll see if I even can trim it, but I mean, so many of my favorite pieces just translate so beautifully, and I'm bringing some of the musicians with me that have played on these scores, in the case of a couple of them, for 20 years.
Wow.
So if people get to hear, the theme from Walking Dead with my violin player playing it, Paul Cartwright, and he played on Battlestar Galactica, and my brother is the one who sang all along the Watchtower in Battlestar Galactica. He's with me, So
Wow, family affair.
it's really exciting, and I think people are going to be I think the set's going to be pretty fun.
There must be some way out of here. Said the Joker to the thief. There's too much confusion. I can't get no relief. Businessmen, they drink my wine. Plowmen dig my earth. None of them along the line.
Well, that's so great. For people who it's the 16th of 18th of April in London, anyway, that people can see you. And I guess it's that thing of kind of, I remember kind of taking my kids to see one of the Star Wars at Royal Albert Hall, with the live playback. And it was so lovely because apart from the experience being something that was such a life memory for us, it really allowed my kids to appreciate how much music there was as part of the storytelling, in those films that they take for granted. You were kind of like, I remember my little one turning around to me and going, I didn't realize there was so much music. The players are playing non-stop. And it was such a nice way for them to appreciate how important that part is to our experience as film and TV fans to that kind of storytelling process. So that must be just wonderful for you to experience live.
It's pretty great, and I do find that in a live context, all this music hits differently. One of the things I'm doing differently than the experience you're describing is, we're not showing picture. Part of this
Yeah.
is like, I want to break that experience out, because one of the things that's funny about music is that it forms this nostalgic connection. When I hear the theme to God of War, I not only think of Kratos, I think of all that I went through to write it, the experience, who I was, who I've become. I'm very nostalgic, but I actually think everyone that knows that music has something similar. They remember their lives when that game came out, or when they played it, or somebody they played it with, or something that happened that was happening in their lives when that music was a big part of it. So
Yeah.
the idea, of hearing it live, it's a celebration of both God of War, but also just
Personal memories.
our collective experience with this music.
Yeah.
And I am excited because I love sharing that with fans. People will say to me, people often, I think, feel compelled to tell me about these experiences outside of the show. Yes, people will say, oh, I really liked your music in Battlestar Galactica. But more often, I hear people say, I got married to your music from Battlestar Galactica. I played this music at my grandmother's funeral. You know, like these were major life events that your music, that. You know, and you realize like, wow, that's not what I intended that music for. Okay. Like I learned that early on in Battlestar. There was a military funeral in Battlestar Galactica in episode 104. Mm. And the next year I got an email from a service member in Iraq.
Oh, wow.
And he buried one of their friends in a military funeral with the military funeral music that I wrote for Battlestar Galactica. And it upset me and shocked me because I thought, well, wait a minute. This isn't supposed to be real life. Like, I'm not writing a real person's funeral, am I, when I do this scene? I'm doing a fiction. Mm. But then I ultimately embraced that once I write this music for this scene, I am giving it away. I am giving it to
It's not yours anymore.
It's not mine anymore. Mm. And I really was honored that that happened and that that person wrote to me. And I think in a way, like, it's like in the spirit of like, let's all celebrate what we love about this music together with the musicians that played it. And I want to experience that with everybody in real time, you know?
Kind of go back and talk a little bit about what it was that kind of got you into this world, you know, in terms of musical storytelling in a way. And, you know, was it something that you'd always wanted to do as a kid? And kind of what was the catalyst to you taking that step into that world, I guess?
I'm going to define as a kid because I was five when I noticed film music and I was six when I was critical about it. I was six. My mom took me to see Back to the Future.
Yeah.
And I loved the music so much that I grabbed my Fisher Price cassette recorder and I made her take me back and I held it in the air.
Aww.
And I recorded the music. And then I went home and I was fast forwarding and rewinding, listening to the music. And I was so annoyed that there was dialogue and sound effects and people laughing. Well, around this time I discovered a thing called a soundtrack album, where they would get rid of all the sound effects and dialogue and I could hear this music. I was obsessed immediately. So that's 6 years old, right? I mean, like that's when I started understanding there's music in these things and I want to understand what it's doing. I was already taking piano lessons. I was starting to like figure out how to play themes. By the time I was 12, I started writing music all day, every day. And it was in the styles of film and that went all the way, you know, today, but in high school in particular, it's like I would push myself. I would write. I was big into sci-fi, fantasy, horror, so I'm writing that kind of stuff. But then I got into westerns. I'm going to write a western theme. Then I saw, like, you know, there are all these great sort of high concept thrillers that would come out in the mid and late 90s. I'm going to write that. I just want to write everything I can imagine, everything I can think of. So I was wired that way, and at that same age, around 16. I met Elmer Bernstein, who,
wow,
my mentor, and I was his last protege or one of his last proteges, and worked with him for the better part of a decade, the last decade of his life. And I met him because of my passion for film music.
Yeah.
There was a mutual friend was like, hey, this kid seems pretty into this, you know? And it was a total coincidence. You know, I grew up a city 100 miles away from Seattle, okay? So it's like, I'm not anywhere near the industry. But you put those two things together, a kid that's wired that way, who decides to put in that work, who then has a chance to meet one of his heroes. And then I moved to LA and my grades were good enough that I got into USC and I got the half ride scholarship that was necessary for my lower middle class mom to send me to that school.
Yeah.
Then I'm in LA at a film school I'm in the music school, but there's a great film school at USC. I start doing student films. I'm conducting little orchestras, and then they become medium orchestras, and then become bigger orchestras, and I'm recording stuff. So you put all that together, and I end up being an assistant on Battlestar Galactica. That gives me a chance to do one episode of Battlestar Galactica. I'm 23 years old. It is irresponsible of them to let a child score this show. They should not do it. But this child, by 23, I've been doing it nonstop for a decade. I put in my 10,000 hours several times. I had built a team to do student films. I had an engineer to record. I had people, I knew how to orchestrate. I knew players. I cobbled together something and it was like everything aligned. And that was really, you know, how I went from being a kid listening to Back to the Future at 5 to scoring Battlestar Galactica at 23.
That's amazing. That, you know, the talents there clearly in terms of what you're able to do, and you sort of go, why are they giving a kid this? But it's like, look at what you've done since then as well. What's lovely is that idea of passing the baton in a way, in the way that Elmer, and there's so many composers that do it, where it's such a kind of inclusive and encouraging environment, you know, where it's kind of like, you know, I want like-minded people, the next generation of like-minded people around me who I can help and support and encourage. And is there something that you kind of, I don't know, not that sort of to kind of classify anything, but kind of when you think of back to that time and having that opportunity to, you know, to work with someone so iconic and in your field sort of thing, of what you took away from that, some of the most kind of memorable or important lessons or things that you learn?
I mean, I learned so much. It's overwhelming.
Yeah.
But I do think there is one thing I learned that stands above the rest. I met Elmer when I was 16. I didn't know any film composers. I'm going to date myself here, but like the internet is very young. Okay. Yeah. So
I know that.
I don't know. I don't know anything about anybody. I could walk past John Williams in the grocery store. I wouldn't recognize his face. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
I do know that Kurt Cobain just died. I do know that Jimi Hendrix died. I do know that George Gershwin and Ravel both died young. I do know that like Beethoven went deaf. Like there's this thing where it's like, do you have to suffer to make music, to be an artist? It's easy to laugh, but when you're 16.
Yeah.
You don't know this. You don't. Mm-hmm. So I met Elmer Bernstein at the height of his career. He's a sweet, thoughtful, funny man with an adoring family. People respect him and he respects himself. Mm. I mean, I met him at a time when he got fired more than any mainstream composer. Famously fired left and right because he's like, this is what I'm going to do and it's what I'm going to do. All right. Like, and if you don't want to do it, it's fine. But I'm not going to do something different. But I respected that. What that meant was he's not desperate. He's not like, oh, let me learn a new trick so that you don't fire me. He didn't care. He's like, look, I'm Elmer Bernstein, right?
Yeah.
Comfortable. He's happy. He's happy. And I was like, there it is. That's what I want. Not the Oscar, not the accolades. I want to be that age and be happy and have a family that loves me and have people in the industry that respect me. Even if they fire me, they respect me, right? Like, so there was so much value there for a 16-year-old. You know, Elmer, you know, he was always looking forward. He was always looking forward, helping young people. What he did with me was not exceptional. He helped a lot of young people. Mm. And I tried very much to do the same at my company, Sparks and Shadows. I don't know that I'll ever be able to repay the universe for putting me in Elmer Bernstein's path, but I'm trying.
Every little helps, Bert. Every little helps. It really, really does. When it comes to, I mean, I was driving through the English countryside. I'm Scottish, you probably heard, maybe you didn't.
Yes.
But I put on some of your Outlander score just because I love how celebratory you are of the culture within the music, you know, both in terms of instrumentation, songs even that you've reworked and used, you know. It was beautiful to just drive around and listening to. I just put, you know, there's so much music there. So I just put it on kind of shuffle so that like what you're going back to saying, like without pictures of it being just you know, of it being about the moment and about the piece of music and where it takes you and what your imagination does with it and stuff. That is a beast of a collection of music that you,
yes.
you've worked on
yes.
for that show, which has the most attentive, huge fan base all over the world.
Yeah. What's funny about that is that I grew up going to the Highland Games up in Bellingham, Washington. So I went to the Highland Games every summer.
No way.
It was my favorite thing would be, you know, there would be like 30 or 40 bands, bagpipe bands, meaning there's hundreds of people on this huge farmland and they would be doing competitions. So you'd hear that B flat for like 8 straight hours, right? And then I would get home and I'd go to bed and it's like, I can still hear it, you know? And the food and the caber toss and the music and the, you know, the dancing, like I loved it. And I'm, wow. you know, part Scottish myself. I am Scottish and Armenian, two fantastic musical heritages
yeah.
there. And my friend, Ronald D. Moore, who show ran and created Battlestar Galactica, you know, I read he got the rights to Outlander. And we were talking about something else. We were emailing about something completely unrelated. And I wrote and I go, oh, by the way, like, I hear you doing Outlander, like, you know, just for fun, like, here's some recordings I did of my favorite Jacobite songs. It's like a little hobby of mine, because it's so fun how the lyrics in these songs, you know, had all these hidden meanings. I think it's fun stuff. And I sent him, you know, 3 or 4 MP3s. And he wrote me back and he was like, or I think he even called me and he's like, wait, you know what a Jacobite is? He goes, I've been spending the last 2 years pitching this show, having to explain this to everybody. You're the first person in LA I've encountered who knows what this is. And then he goes, oh, I listened to those MP3s. That's great. I really like that Sky Boat song. I think that's our main title. And I was like, I guess I'm scoring Outlander now.
Did you ever imagine, though, that it would become the thing that it has? You know, I know that we're in the final season's been shot and then the prequels come in. It's kind of, you know, it's been amazing what it's done for the, you know, for the industry in Scotland and craftsmen and women. And it's just the gift that keeps on giving on so many levels.
I was going to ask, as a Scottish person, how do you feel about it?
It's wonderful. I think it's there's so many things that I love about it. I love the storytelling in it. I love that mix of kind of genres within it. I love that it kind of is this constant regeneration of new talent that we get to learn about. People like, you know, Sam and Katrina are fantastic, but people like Lauren Lyle, who's just phenomenal, you know. And so that side of it, but then also hearing from production side of it, you know, and kind of new, you know, exciting storytellers who are getting their foot in the door by working on this show. Because from someone who had to leave Scotland to find work, to know that there is this industry that's vibrant and is constantly kind of giving people opportunities is so wonderful. So I'm so grateful for the show on so many levels. So yeah, I think it's amazing.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, to answer your question, I didn't know. I didn't know that when I made demos of the Sky Boat song for the main title. Mm. It was an accordion doing the melody in one version. It was a fiddle in another version. It was a penny whistle in another. And then my wife, who was at that time, I think 7 months pregnant with our first child, Rhea, I said, I don't know. Why don't we try a vocal version? Come on in and sing it. You know, I did not know in that moment that we were making a piece of music that would resonate with people so deeply that they would tattoo it on their bodies, you know, that it would resonate with millions of people, millions of times. I'm glad I didn't know, because the pressure of it would have just been immense. It was just something beautiful. I felt like I was connecting with my own Scottish heritage. My wife was singing the demo. It never even occurred to me that that'd be the final performance.
While she's carrying your child. It's just
yes.
My God.
It's funny because we made revisions. The first idea, Ron said, very smart idea. We were doing the original Robert Louis Stevenson lyrics. Sing me a song of a lad that is gone. And he goes, I don't know. It feels like we're talking about Claire here. We should say lass. And I was like, change Your idea, like, I thought people would be outraged. Sing Me a Song of a Lass That Is Gone. Mm. That did two things. A, it very much makes it feel like it's about Claire. Yes. B, when I see it tattooed on your flesh and it's Sing Me a Song of a Lass with an S, I know you're an Outlander fan. You're not a Scottish folk music enthusiast. You're an Outlander fan. So that was fun. But we did the final takes. Rhea was 8 months pregnant. Oh, and man. She even said to me, she goes, if they want it louder than this or bigger than, like, my diaphragm, I've got this person pushing on it. I cannot sing this again. And I said, Rhea, this is the one. I'm telling you, I think this is the one. And that is the recording that, you know, has 48 million spins on Spotify. Who's counting?
Wow. That's incredible. Oh, yeah. Man, that's so exciting.
Sing me a song of a lass that is gone. Say, could that lass be I? Mary of soul, she sailed on a day over the sea to sky. Mull was a stem, rum on the port, eck on the starboard bow. Glory of youth glowed in his soul. Where is that glory now? Sing me a song of a lass that is gone. Say, could that lass be I? Mary of soul, she sailed on a jay over the sea to sky.
It's so great, like, when you think about, you know, when you kind of just even glance down your you know, the work that you've done. You mentioned The Walking Dead there as well, which is just extraordinary. Percy Jackson as well, we really enjoyed that, loved that. And then, but then coming on to something like, I want to talk about games in a second, because I think that the music in games is really not celebrated enough. Do you know what I mean? I feel like it's kind of, it's such...
It's getting there.
So many of my favorite, you know, Pinner Toprak, who I've spoken to quite a lot, you know, in terms of her background in gaming and stuff. It's just, it's so part of the experience. It's like, anyway, but Lord of the Rings, coming in on to something like Lord of the Rings and the Rings of Power, where there's a kind of pre-existence there as well. Is that something you have to consider?
It's not my first rodeo. I don't know if that's a phrase in Scotland, but it's a phrase over here.
Not your first Highland Games, Bear.
It's not my first Highland Games. It's not my first caber toss here, okay? That playing with an IP that has a fan base, mm-hmm. that I'm in. You know, I've done Battlestar Galactica, Terminator, Godzilla, Child's Play, God of War, Halo. I mean, it's more often than not, I'm in that situation. In the case of The Lord of the Rings, I fundamentally didn't approach it any differently than any other, which is that I need to tell the story at hand. And I need to tell the story at hand with music that I would like to hear there. I need to trust my showrunners and collaborators that if I'm wrong, they'll correct me, right? Mm. And that once we, as we're all fans, I like this music and they like this music, that fans will like this music. So fundamentally, Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power was not more intimidating than anything else.
Yeah.
If anything, you know, I had the freedom to sort of really branch out in any way that I wanted. We're thousands of years before the events of the Peter Jackson films, for anybody who doesn't know the lore. And in those Peter Jackson films, there's only a couple characters that are even possible to be relevant in our show. Mm-hmm. So it's not like I felt like, oh God, you know, the show's not going to work if it's a different theme for Sauron. Because ultimately, like, you want this to sort of stand on its own. And, I mean, I'm sort of burying the lead here. We have this incredible Howard Shore theme. We've got that box checked. Howard Shore wrote the main theme for the show, the main title. Mm. It exists. He is welcoming fans, including me, from Peter Jackson's films. And from there, we're taking them on a new journey. something I ever worried about because, like, I trusted my tastes.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I think it's cool that the Harfoots have some Celtic instrumentation because thousands of years from now, they're going to settle in the Shire and it's going to sound like that.
Yeah.
So obviously, I'm not going to do something that's totally off base. You
like
know, at
that.
The same time, second season, I started getting a little more daring. You know, we're going to a part of the map, the lands in the east of Rune that have never been depicted before. And so I used Bulgarian women's choir, featured prominently, because it's like, well, I'm going to bring in a new sound. Never seen Numenor in the Peter Jackson film. So I used a lot of Mediterranean, North African, and Egyptian instrumentation, Turkish, Armenian instrumentation, which sort of pulls the sound of Lord of the Rings that people expect in new places. Like, I just went nuts in season two, and this troll walks out and starts brutalizing friend and foe alike in this big battle, and I'm watching it. And yeah, look, I just put out the Singularity. It's a metal record. And I just thought, I want to hear the lead singer from Meshuggah, my favorite death metal band, during this moment. And that's what you hear. You know, we did a death metal song in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah,
it felt right. This is what I'm saying. I trust my instincts.
Yeah.
Because I'm a fan. I grew up immersed in this stuff. And I am where I am in terms of my tastes. And I trust the people around me. Like, is it weird to do a death metal song? And like, no, they like it. They like it. And ultimately, the fans liked it. I mean, the fans really embraced it. So I ultimately have my own taste. I will say I am by far my harshest critic. By far. Like, when I'm writing a theme, if I get to the point where I go, you know what? I think that's pretty good. Mm-hmm. It has gone through its paces, you know? So anyway, yeah, I love that challenge, but ultimately it is all about telling the story at hand using the tools I think are best.
with gaming and writing music, it's like, where do you start? Because you can't preconceive, particularly when it's gameplay, do you know what I mean? Something, you know, where you kind of, you can't predict people's movements. There's a challenge, there's a quest, you know what I mean, in some of it. But in terms of how then you write music based around that, it feels like it's almost like, it's like a magician in terms of kind of,
yeah,
you know, that idea that there is music there available for every scenario that could possibly come up. It's mental. My brain kind of explodes just thinking about it. So Christ knows how you actually write it, come up with the ideas, the themes, the kind of the instrumentation, and then, yeah, well, make it all work.
To do that well, mm-hmm. and I have been fortunate to work with teams, development teams that do it very well, the best in the industry. Mm. It takes a large team. It's me, the game directors, my music team, their audio team, all working together. It's like building that barn in Witness. You remember the old movie, and all the Amish people are building the barn, and you're like, it takes everybody to build this barn, right? That's what it is like doing a game score. That's a weird analogy. And again, I'm just dating myself here.
I'm sure
kids are going to be like, what the hell? By the way,
they're all going to go and watch Witness now, so it's fine.
But speaking of soundtracks, talk about an oddity. Go watch Witness, one of the most unusual film scores in terms of the timbre of the score versus the material of the film. Fascinating. Yeah. One of my favorite scores to talk about. I won't say it's one of my favorite to listen to, but okay. I digress. Let's not talk about Witness.
That film is 40 years old.
Dude, we're getting there. We're getting there.
Jeez, Louise, that's crazy.
The thing that matters most for me in a game is not that. I mean, that is complicated. Mm. But writing a theme that tells a story is 99% of the experience. Maybe I'm being a little unfair, but this is just my perspective. That when Corey Barlog, the director of God of War, sat me down and said, this game is the story of a grieving father and his estranged son. And they have to take the ashes of their deceased wife and mother to the highest peak in all the realms per her dying wish. And along the way, their fractured relationship goes through trials and tribulations till they finally come to some sort of understanding and they become better people for getting to know each other. Well, it's like, well, I know how to do that. I don't care if that's a game. Like, I know how to do that. Yeah. Elmer Bernstein taught me how to do that. Okay. That's a story. So writing the thematic material to do that is such a big part of your experience, your son's experience playing the game. Yes, it matters that the adaptive layers change when you are doing better or worse in a combat scenario. I'm not going to say it doesn't matter, but what makes the game memorable is that story. And one of the things that makes that story work is that theme and the interplay of those themes with the story. So fundamentally, it all boils down to the basics. I mean, I worked on God of War for 4 years. However, if all I did was give them da 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 da, and then I walked away, I'd still say I made a big contribution to God of War. like so much of what matters in God of War's music is right there, and in the other themes that I wrote. I don't want to downplay it, but I guess what I'm saying is, like, so much of the other technical stuff involves working with the teams and mm-hmm. getting them the pieces they need to do all that technical stuff. It's not that it's easy, but it's like, it's almost like I'm giving you options. I don't have to think about it. It's like, here's 50 different ways you can solve that problem. You solve the problem of how to code it. I'm not going to worry about that. What I'm going to worry about is what Corey said, the story of the grieving estranged father and son. That's my job, right? That's not a code thing. That's not a technical thing. That's an art, emotion, music yeah. task. That is where I feel like my journey and my skill set have been honed.
Amazing. Listen, I've kept you longer than I meant to have.
All good.
And I know you've got a busy, busy day. I'm so grateful for your time, and it's been wonderful to chat to you. I hope we can do this again on 18th of April for people who want to come along and watch the show. It just, you know, it just themes and variations, Indigo at the O2 in London. It just sounds epic.
It'll be massive.
Yeah, it's going to be amazing. Bear, I really appreciate your time and huge congrats. And I'm so excited to continue to be just impressed and enjoy watching your journey as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This was delightful.
God of War Ragnarok, which I've heard in my house a lot because we really loved that game. That is the title track by Bear McCreary. Rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking, huge thanks to Bear for taking the time to talk to me, also for his team for reaching out and making that happen. What an absolute delight he is. You can catch him at the Indigo O2 in London on April the 18th with details of how to get tickets at bearmccreary.com. Head to edithbowman.com to catch up with every single episode of Soundtrack, and including my chats with the wonderful Pinar Toprak about her work on video games. Whilst if you want to jump onto socials, we are at Soundtracking UK. We also have a YouTube channel, which we'd really appreciate you subscribing to. It's called Soundtracking Extra. We'll be back on Monday with the wonderful Hans Zimmer and Paul Dugdale. We all know who Hans Zimmer is. Paul Dugdale is a wonderful director who's got an incredible CV of making brilliant programming around mainly music and live performances, the likes of Ed Sheeran, Coldplay, Dua Lipa, many, many others. And Hans brought him in to work on this fantastic new film that is hitting cinemas on the 18th of March. So Paul and Hans join us to discuss this fantastic, wonderful film that they've worked on together. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.
5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.